Yeah, I just happen to have a computer program built into the handy talkie that's in my hand right now. Where you plug in the frequency, the diameter of the dish, you assume 60% aperture efficiency because you've just designed a real good feed horn, and I can tell you what the gain is going to be. I don't know right now. I'm gonna be running that between now and the beginning of the mailbag, and then I'll come back with an answer. But I think the answer is going to be very, very close to 16.5 dB of gain over a dipole on a 10-foot diameter dish. One good long Yagi will do that for you. The Yagi has in the vicinity of 2 square foot of wind load. A 10-foot diameter dish is something like 60 square foot of wind load, unless you've got very, very low density mesh on the dish. So the dish gives you a lot more wind load. See, dish antennas, let me drop. A parabolic dish antenna starts shining, starts performing well when you get well above 1,000 megacycles, 1296, 2304. By the time you get up to 10 gigs, boy, you're starting to get a lot of gain in a hurry out of a parabolic dish if the surface is smooth enough up there at 10 gigs. But when it comes to frequencies below 1,000 megs, unless somebody has given you a 28-foot dish, when it comes to reasonable-sized dishes you can put up on a tower, like a 10-foot, you're going to come out way ahead on wind load and the performance and whatever with Yagis. So I'm a real strong enthusiast of Yagis. Four Yagis on 432 could very well have 7 or 8 dB more gain than that 10-foot dish. One long Yagi, one 21-element Yagi, and that 10-foot dish are going to come out so close in gain that you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Would you rather mount a 21-element Yagi, an F9 FT, or a 10-foot dish if they were equal in gain and you know what the difference in wind load is? Make sure you wait for the beeps, Barry. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Okay, 1 second. Same work. Okay, I got it. As you can tell, I got a phone call, so I'll be back over later. But thanks for the information. I went through my problem.
Yeah, I found the program. I'll be giving you an answer a little bit later. So there's many a person who looks at a parabolic dish because it looks so nice and elaborate. It looks so high in performance. I mean, sitting on the ground, it looks like it's moving a million miles an hour as an antenna, if you know what I mean. And you take a look at the August issue, 1972 QST magazine, way back in the dark ages, and you look at that 12-foot stressed parabolic dish that I used at 2.3 gigahertz to listen to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts directly when they were on the moon. Yes, to me, that's a very pretty-looking antenna. And I did use that 12-foot dish down at 432 at an antenna gain contest. I vaguely remember the antenna gain was something like 17 dB over isotropic, which is around 15 dB over dipole. Huge piece of hardware, and you can easily top that gain with one well-tuned Yagi and have 5% or 10% of the wind load and 5% or 10% of the amount of steel and aluminum up in the air, if you know what I mean. So above 1,000 megs and further above 1,000 megs, parabolic dish start really performing. Below 1,000 megs, the Yagi antenna, even though you look down that boom and your eye says, gee, there's nothing there, I'm going to drop. One of the best antenna formulas in the world is area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug the numbers into that formula, gain equals area. Area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain times lambda squared, all divided by 4 pi. And the gain has to be a hard number, not decibels. You gotta take the decibels back out of the number, if you know what I mean, mathematically. You do, and if you plug in the area, gain lambda squared, yeah, if you plug in lambda and square it, but if you plug in lambda in square feet, and in feet or meters, your answer will come out in square feet or square meters. Once you know the real gain of your antenna, assuming that the antenna manufacturer is telling you the truth, assume your antenna's got 17 dB and 17 as an anti-log number, I think is 50. If the gain is 50 to 1, that's 17 dB, you plug in 50 for that formula, and Lambda is around 2 feet on 432. Squared is around 4 divided by 4 pi. You can find out what this area is going to be. A good Yagi on 432 has an area of around 6 or 7 foot diameter with 100% efficiency. That's 100% efficiency formula. Because your dish is only going to give you something like 55% efficiency on a good day, particularly when it's down that lower frequency, where the feed horn is giving you a substantial blockage, you'd be lucky to get 50% efficiency. That means you've got to make another 30% increase in that diameter, if you know what I mean. So even though your eye doesn't see it, a good long Yagi has a ridiculous amount of real electrical capture area. If your eye operated at that frequency, you'd see a good long Yagi on 432, you'd see a hole in space that is something like 8 feet in diameter where it sucks up all the signal, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, time out.
Even though the elements of the Yagi are only 1 foot long, a good long Yagi on 432 can have 7 or 8 foot diameter capture area. That's the focusing effect you get out of that long string of directors. Although your eye doesn't see it, that is one huge magnifying glass in space using Huygens' principle, if you know what I mean. So well-tuned Yagis give you the most amount of bang for the dollar, bang for wind load, bang for pound of aluminum, and so on. So when it comes to frequencies below 432, as I said, unless somebody gives you a 60-foot or a 28-foot diameter dish, go Yagis, in my opinion. Okay, John, have we missed anybody that's been trying to sign in? And go right out to the mailbag. And I hope you had a chance to talk to Caroline. Boy, did she ask us one hell of a question 2 weeks ago. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
One more comment, Dick, if I may, and to we out.
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I don't want to be a hog and take up too much time, but maybe if you get a chance, not tonight, but take a look online at HoverRound, HOVERROUND. You see a picture of it. Maybe next week, give me some ideas how you think a way to mount the radio and to mount the radio so we get mild rain, it doesn't affect it. And where I could put the antenna, where I could mount the ground plane. Anyway, let me turn it back to you, turn it over to John. You don't have to give me those answers tonight. And to we go.
Drama.
Now, on top of that, Rich, somebody did offer you a TP mount for the middle of the roof, and the price was right last week. I hope you had a chance to, or sometime in the future, have a chance to take advantage of that. The person who offered you a TP mount, because I know your chimney is off to one side, and so it's just a matter of time before you're going to want to put more antennas on the roof. And you may get a little bit of flack in the house because of the beauty of antennas, but people don't look up in the air. They don't see. Everybody who has ever visited you, ask them what's the color of the shingles on your house, and they'll be surprised to find out they all don't know. People don't look up in the air. Barry? Anyway, here we go. John, KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WTV. Dick, I believe a comment is being offered by Rich, KC2PS, about the wheelchair radio. Maybe you want to pick him up first.
Yeah, he's leaving Ohio, heading for West Virginia. And so now we're going to be getting the West Virginia opinion. I'm having some fun with Rich. K2UPS, Uniform Papa Sierra Mobile, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening again, Dick, K2UPS Mobile, Pennsylvania now. My only concern with that setup is running a 45-watt VHF or UHF signal a foot from his head. You know, you're talking about putting a gain, you're not talking about even if it was a quarter wave whip, but anything more than that, that's going to be a gain antenna. That's a lot of RF really close to my head. I'm not comfortable doing that. I'd much just be using an HT, and I was going to suggest 10 with 2000, but if he wanted to just use this around the house, and out in the yard, he could use an HT to then talk back to a crossband radio in his house that would then put out higher power. That would give him the flexibility and a lot more safer in terms of RF exposure, in my opinion. Go ahead, Dick.
You brought up a very good point, Rich. And when in doubt, don't just speculate, make measurements is one of my philosophies. When in doubt, make measurements. Yes, if we take Barry's suggestion of a handy talkie that talks back to the house where the rig is talking to a good antenna on the top of the house, that's one very good approach. If he also wants to run, let me pick a number, 30 or 40 watts, 2-meter mobile, for instance, from the wheelchair. And if there's a tall enough pole on the wheelchair so that the antenna is, let me pick a number, 3 or 4 feet above his head, although you would have some fear of that, there's two things in his favor. Number one, depending on what frequency he's on, the so-called 1, 3, or 10, depending on which one of the standards you look at for informed and uninformed requirement. He's an informed requirement. He's an informed person. And since there's a 6-minute integration factor built into the American National Standard Institute standard for minimum, for maximum allowed exposure, radio frequency biohead, it takes the most vulnerable part of the human being is the eyes, and it takes 6 minutes to heat up the eye. Your eye has got a 6-minute time constant. So if he makes a 1-minute transmission, he can use 6 times more power. Very rough guess, so to speak. If the antenna is above your head, and if the antenna has an antenna pattern, it's aimed out to the horizon, and not as much comes down to the head. And when in doubt, there's various guys. Let me drop. There's various members of this club who have access to a radiation hazard detecting meter, radio frequency biohazard, or what's it called now, power flux density. There's various kinds of meters where you can literally make the measurement. You tease the transmitter, and you hold the piece of test equipment near his head, near his face, near his neck, near his chest, and so on, and really make measurements. I've done that on a couple of occasions, and when you do that, 90-some-odd percent of the time, you're amazed how low the real number is, even though you think it's not going to be. When in doubt, make measurements. And, of course, add the right kind of a safety factor to it. I know it is possible. Should he put the antenna 1 foot in front of his face at exactly his face level and transmit 40 watts, stare into the antenna, and do it for a 6-minute key down? Absolutely not. But he's smart enough not to do that particular combination. We're all going to design for him an antenna that's high enough above his head with an antenna pattern aimed out to the horizon. We're going to measure how many milliwatts per square centimeter he's going to be exposed to. We know what frequency he's on. We know how long he's going to be making the transmissions. He's an informed user, and therefore it could be done safe. He's not going to be doing it with his eyes aiming straight into the antenna, if you know what I mean. But you brought up a good point, and we should make those measurements. You probably have some further comments on this one, Rich. You brought up a good one. K2UPS in Pennsylvania. Mobile, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That was it. Just to keep the RF away from the body. And instead of trying to use an inverter, he could also just get a separate battery to only run the radio and keep it completely separate from the electrical system in the car. Then you don't have to worry about running out in the middle of Main Street. So, but that was it. Back to you, K2UPS.
Yeah, the slight problem with the completely separate battery. The good news is now it's not draining the battery on his mobile, on his movable chair. So therefore, the chair will still have the same amount of mileage. That's the good news. My experience with using a standard 12-volt type of a battery, like a motorcycle battery, an automobile battery, is that you get, at best, 12.0 volts after a line drop to the rig. And when you're using a rig intended for mobile service, which is designed for 13.8 volts, and you give it 12.0, my particular Kenwood 751, I think it's the model number, I'm looking at the darn thing right now, I think it's 751, every one of the five separate Kenwood 751 2-meter all-modes mobile rigs that I've ever used, 30 watts output capability, if they don't see something like 12.8 volts and above, they misbehave. I'll bet you half the mobile rigs out there have some of that characteristic. So running from a pure 12-volt battery that is not being charged at the time could give you grief, just something to worry about in the beginning from my point of view. There's a lot more we'll eventually learn about this whole procedure as Rich proceeds with this operation of his. So, back to you, Rich, on KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. And good information, Rich. Yeah, that is very important. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll go on to my first question. All right, Dick. This gentleman is asking a question about communication. It seems to be commercial mostly. He'd like to know what trunk it means. What does it mean? What is it used for? And how is it used? Maybe you can explain that to him. Back to you, Dick. Thank you, KC2WGB. All right,
okay, I warn you guys ahead of time. I'm not an expert in this area. I'll tell you what little I know. I'm going to pass it over to the net for people to give more information. There are a number of commercial frequencies. In the 800 meg, for instance, 800 megacycle region of commercial radio systems intended for taxi cab and emergency vehicle and whatever dispatching, where a particular frequency has been assigned, they recognize ahead of time that this particular taxi cab service really only has to transmit 5% of the time. 95% of the time, the radio is sitting there idle, doing nothing. As such, they could, for instance, have three or four separate taxi cab companies simultaneously using the exact same frequency. Each individual taxi cab company, the individual taxi cabs and the dispatching center will have their own, let me call it PL tone. Not exactly a PL tone, it's sometimes digital. They'll have their own individual PL tone going through the repeater. Therefore, taxi cab brand A and dispatching center brand A, when they're on the air with their particular PL tone, they make a transmission to their particular taxi cabs and all the other brands, the brand B, C, and D, do not hear those transmissions. Once in a while, both taxi cab companies want to make a transmission simultaneously, and one of them is going to get a busy signal for the next 10 seconds or so. But that trunking system is where a group of people are all using the exact same frequency with their own encoding technique so that all of their people only hear their particular transmissions on that frequency. As long as everybody is using a low enough duty factor, the whole system works very well. That's my understanding of trunking. I may have some of the details wrong. Some of you experts out there in communication, please give us your words.
Repeater, time out.
I'm double checking. I haven't timed out the Eastern repeater. I hope it hasn't timed out the IRLP or the Echolink. So you guys out there with more trunking experience, please correct some of my errors on this one. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, either I didn't make any mistakes or there isn't anybody out there with more information on the subject. It's called trunk because each individual user has his own clothing trunk, so to speak, by which he's able to transport his clothing. Well, in this case, they're transporting their particular pieces of information, but it's only going to the right place. It's like the baggage handler of a good airport that does things correctly. The baggage always goes to the right place. Well, the information goes from the right dispatching center to the right user, even though multiple people are using the same frequency. But each of the people, it's like a kind of a party line. It's like a party line where in the old days of party line telephone, if you picked up the telephone at the wrong time, yes, you heard other people's conversations. The advantage of the trunking system is that you do not hear the undesired, the other people's conversations. You only hear the conversation from your particular company because of the equivalent of the PL tone. But I think it's really a digital code that's doing it. KC2WGB. Give enough delay in case somebody else comes along with more information on trunking systems. K2IIW in the TechNet.
K2YO.
There's a man who knows how it's done. Tell us about it, Bernie.
Evening, Dick in the net. Dick, you're on the right track, but let's expand that out some. The concept of trunking comes out of the telephone industry, where you have the model of that a number of circuits, in this case frequencies, and those frequencies are not necessarily needed by everybody at every time, so they're shared. So let's say that we're a company and we have four or five departments need radios. We've got, in the old world, we would have 15 frequencies. Well, instead of 15 frequencies, let's say we have 6 frequencies. Want to drop?
Bernie, give us as much audio as you can. As you know, this crazy AGC system of the controller is going up and down, and so periodically your audio becomes quite low. Over to you, Bernie.
The audio I've got, could the people on the control panel shut off the southern input? That will help. So anyway, we have these trunks, and your radio has intelligence built into it. And so each message that is transmitted has a digital header on it and says, this is for talk group X. So let's say this is talk group 12. My radio says, I'm not 12, I'm not going to open up the 12 and let them hear that. But I am in group 5, so when a message comes through that has a header of group 5, it will let me hear that. And so it's a way that you can have a lot of different talk groups sharing the same trunks, meaning frequencies, and all coexist on the same frequencies. If the system is properly rated, then nobody ever gets a busy system.
Yeah, thank you, Bernie. And now, up till now, I thought a kid system with the people that are all grouped together would use one single frequency, but multiple addressing techniques. You've now described it as multiple frequencies, again, with addressing. So I'm beginning to believe that the individual user, let's say a taxi cab, would have a receiver that now scans all three frequencies simultaneously and sequentially, looking for its particular addressing code. And when it sees its addressing code on either frequency 1, 2, or 3, it then opens up the audio, locks onto that frequency, and listens to the message from its particular dispatching center. So I think, if I understand you correctly, not only is there addressing, but there's multiple frequencies that can be used so that now there's a much lower probability that somebody's going to get a busy signal because somebody's already on, so to speak. Is that approximately what's going on here, Bernie? Beautiful sounding system. K2 Yankee Oscar, shout into that mic as much as you can. K2LAW in the TechNet.
My knowledge is about 10 or 15 years old at this point. At that time, there were two different systems, and how they did it was differently. The radio is not sitting looking at all 10 or 15 trunks at any given time. I believe there's a control channel that just is constantly blasting out these messages. There may be actually multiple control channels that are different size, but it is saying trunk 5 is now sub route 15, trunk 6 is now 7, trunk 3 is, you know, et cetera. And so you just look at the control channel. If you see a pairing that matches your, shall we say, interest, then your radio goes there.
Interesting. So there's a control channel that the remote guys listen to know then where they should really go to hear their particular piece of information. I think I see what's going on here. Very good. So the stuff, when it comes to combining a good modern-day radio system with a good modern-day computer system and a good piece of software, man, what a marriage that is. Wow. And what amazes the daylights out of me is that every good electrical engineering school makes sure they have an update computer science department, and they change the curriculum almost every semester to keep it current. But the modern-day computers would be useless without the radio equipment connected to it. Everybody is carrying this Wi-Fi handheld pocket thing, cell phone-like thing, which gives them internet connectivity and all kinds of other things. A beautiful marriage of computers, software, and RF. And the RF is equally as important from my point of view. Without the RF, you got nothing. And without the computer, you got nothing. You need both. And the schools are doing such a mediocre or less than mediocre job of teaching the wireless portion of it. the radio portion, particularly antenna design. It's a bunch of opinions. I've said it for a long time. I really wish the schools would do something about that. So I think we're slowly getting a little smarter on this one now. John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Technophile. Go ahead there, Barry. And Benny.
John, to your original poster, hopefully you're listening. Definitely make it a point to go to Ham Radio University next January out in Long Island. There's a gentleman, I can't remember if it's call sign, it says K2LIE or K2LIE. One of them is DJ, the other one is a gentleman that just puts on the seminar, and he does a wonderful explanation of what trunking is and how it works. The seminar is actually on scanning, but anybody that's into scanning, if you're going to try to scan a trunk system, you have to have this kind of knowledge. UFO?
Yeah, I'm going to repeat that message. Your audio dropped down 15 or 18 dB, Bernie. So do plan on going to Ham Radio University, HRU, Ham Radio University, the beginning of January every year, held in Old Bethpage at the, I told you something, I can't think of the name of the college. Anyhow, Limock runs Briarcliff College. Well done. So Briarcliff College, and thank you, Briarcliff College, early January every year. It's taken place now at least 6, 7, 8 times. Very well done. Sunday afternoon, Sunday morning, Sunday all day, Ham Radio University. And so K2LIE or W2LIE, one or the other, will be giving a discussion on trunking, among many other things. And so there's a whole bunch of classes you can go to. The price is right. Lots of information. Lots of good guys to talk to. Be there or be square. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
K2CX.
K2CX, the thought of your name, and if you've got information on this particular subject, please proceed. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I'm Dick. You should know my name. K2CX, Stephen. If there's any other questions the station has, if there are any other questions you find regarding trunking, pretty much everything's on the board from the other station, but many things have changed. The original systems that went on in the air back in the 70s are all gone today. But the telecommunication system, higher grades of trunking with more and more bandwidth and control channels to the system. Now we have trunking systems with multiple frequencies at different sites, with multiple frequencies at another site, all held together by computers. How do you do? Thank you again.
Very fine, Steve. Steve checks into the TechNet once every 2 years because I couldn't put it together. And sorry about that. Didn't recognize you. I know him very well from way back, one of our local technical advisors. I know he's got a more formal title than that, but that's the title I'm going to give for the time being. Thank you for the information, Steve. Steve, do you think you will be involved in this particular subject during the next Ham Radio University, K2 Charlie X-Ray, K2RIW?
No, negative. W2LIE has a great put-together, has a great site on the Internet with all the frequencies and scanner types would be interested in listening to. And it gives a good discussion of scanner people interest. Basically, it's all a bunch of numbers, groups, subgroups that are within a company. You end up with a group like Joe's Plumbing Company, and within Joe's Plumbing Company, there's an administrative subgroup that there's four vehicles on, or four handhelds on. And then they'd have another subgroup that's the guys that go around cleaning pipes. They'd have another subgroup that the fellas that do installations on, and on and on and on. And then they could have an all group where they can talk to everybody in the company should they be exactly. And that's basically the way all that stuff's done, whether it be Nassau County Police or otherwise.
Glad to hear from you, Steve. Good information. Steve, correct me, because I probably got your title wrong. Do my knowledge, you are a American Radio Relay League appointee for the Hudson Division, and I think your title is something like Technical Advisor for the Hudson Division, New York City, Long Island section. Am I even close, Rich, Steve, K2 Charlie X-Ray, K2 LIW? Yeah, you're pretty close.
I would give you a cigar for that. The actual title is a section appointment. I've been the technical coordinator for the section that supervises and appoints technical folks in the area to assist hands with problems. I spend a decent amount of time helping people out with interference issues within their QTHs and otherwise. And also are involved with another hat or two that we don't need to get into in the text.
Okay, well done. As you guys have heard me say so often, there's a lot of brain power in the tri-state area around New York City, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, eastern Long Island, here we go, western Long Island, western Connecticut. And so we also, from time to time, tap into the brain power that exists in the Golden Horseshoe, among other places of Canada. Thank you all, you guys. Back to you, John. And thank the person who asked the question. He got us on a good one. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Yes, occasionally we do get some really interesting questions. And I thank the people for the information. Briar Court College in January. Okay, I will send an email over to him. I don't know if you'll be able to make that. He lives quite a distance from here, but you might be able to. I'm going to drop him one to the next one. All right, Dick. It's a good one. This gentleman just bought a new car, and it is total fiberglass. He wants to install a 2-meter 440 brake, which he has in his other car, but he wants to know what kind of an antenna. Maybe we have some information, people around that have that are listening, that could drop in to let us know what they've used. But what type of antenna, what should you look for, and what's his best guess on getting this done? Back to you, Dick. Please, you do the GP.
Yeah, I've got an opinion on this one. It's a little bit radical. Being an antenna designer, I claim to be an antenna designer because I filed a significant number of antenna patents, some of which have been granted and some of which are in production. My opinion of antennas in an insulated environment, a fiberglass car, is such that establishing a good ground plane antenna, vertical ground plane, where you've got a counterpoise, usually the sheet metal at the top of the car, and a quarter wave or a 5/8 wave radiators sticking up perpendicular from it. That's the conventional way of going. That's what I call a quasi-unbalanced antenna. Dipole-like antennas are thoroughly balanced, require no local ground. When you set up that dipole at 80 meters parallel to the ground or perpendicular to the ground in your backyard, depending on how you do it, if the full dipole is a half wavelength long and you're feeding it from the outer edge, and if it's vertical, or if it's horizontal and you're feeding it in the center, that antenna does not require local ground to give full performance. So as long as you choose a thoroughly half wave or thoroughly resonant independent antenna, by independent I mean one that doesn't require a bunch of ground plane radios, doesn't require a counterpoise. A dipole is one of those. There's various ways that you can set up an antenna such that it almost doesn't require the sheet metal of the car. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say it's the conventional off-the-shelf antenna. But if you dig deep enough into the antenna design, that's one possible approach. Another approach, let me drop. Another approach that many people have used is to reestablish the missing metal on the top of the car by copper tape, aluminum tape, and various individual wires or whatever. It can be done. It's not always quite as desirable, and you probably, if you're not real careful, you're going to end up with some RF energy flowing down the outside of the coax. I prefer the balanced antenna, but it can be done. But I know that Glenn, KC2QIQ, among other guys, have solved this problem with fiberglass. Glenn is a Corvette owner, a person who really loves Corvette automobiles, which are also all fiberglass. And to my knowledge, he has successfully put antennas on it. So anybody who has put a 2-meter antenna or an HF antenna on a fiberglass automobile, give us your words on that right now. Give me your call letters. K2LIW and the TechNet, standing by. Okay. We don't have the right people available right now, apparently. So there are kinds of antennas that do not require local grounded pieces of sheet metal. Balanced antennas are one possible approach. As you go to a half-wave-like antenna, electronic half-wave, it can have a loading coil in the center, but as long as the antenna itself electronically is half-wave, the radiator, and you're feeding the outer dimension of that by way of a frequency, a feed and step-up device, which is a very simple LC network, an L network is what it's called, which you can design by way of the Berkeley program. You Google the word Berkeley and impedance match with Google, and you'll come up with a very nice program by way of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. You know that the outer dimension, if you feed a dipole from the outer edge, there's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the center. You can feed it anywhere you want. The dipole is a kind of a flywheel, and you can decide you're going to put energy into the flywheel by having the push rod close to the pivot point or out near the perimeter, so to speak. Want to drop? Okay, Steve recognized. Get you in a second. So you can feed the outer dimension of the radiator if it's a half-wave radiator. You're feeding approximately a 2,000 ohm impedance. When you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance, you almost don't need a counterpoise. Lots of guys have very successfully fed a half-wave length 20-meter helically wound vertical antenna. Feed the outer dimension of it using nothing more as a counterpoise than the metal railing of the balcony of their apartment. It had some extremely good performance. So you don't necessarily need a whole bunch of ground plane radials if you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance because you're feeding the outer dimension of a halfway radiator. K2, Charlie X-ray, how would you solve that one, Steve? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Half-wave antennas have been around a long time. I wonder if anyone that's on the net tonight, and I can't remember the manufacturer's name, but back in the days, early days of 2 meters, there was a manufacturer that made, I think, only one antenna. It was a half-wave once long, and on the bottom of it, it had a metal covered coil, and it had a specific manufacturer's name that everybody used to speak about, and I can't remember it. But they're still available for both. Reason? Fiberglass. The halfway design, no ground plane required. I put halfway designs on ambulances with fiberglass spots, and we've also placed copper, stick-on copper strap and sided in to make a reasonably sized ground plane to take care of it when you want to point the antenna's low because of the height of the antenna. But that antenna is still available. Very obvious. Maybe somebody on the net can remember the name. I can't call it. Back to you.
You might have to repeat that. That audio is extremely low.
Yeah, many guys are running into low audio tonight, and it's not their fault. There's something a little bit funny going on with the repeater itself, where there's kind of an audio AGC function that at the beginning of the transmission, the audio is right. 2 seconds later, it jumps down by 10 dB. And so it's one of the things that Eric is working on. So most of you guys are going to have to shout into the mic, if you know what I mean. So what Steve is telling us is that he has installed a number of half-wave antennas at fiberglass structures like ambulances, for instance. There is a manufacturer, he remembers, that has a half-wave radiator antenna with the loading coil in the bottom of it, and it was a popular brand name. I think a J-Pole also comes kind of close. On 2 meters, home brewing an antenna doesn't require expensive materials. So once you know you're looking for half-wave-like antenna, J-Pole comes close. A number of the so-called 5/8 wave mag mounts. Let me drop it.
J-2, YGT with info.
Well, the offensive input, I believe. Maybe it'll change. Let's see.
Okay, thank you, Lou. And Matt has some information, too. You know, the 5/8 wave mag mounts have a loading coil on the bottom, which is really an impedance step-up device because you're feeding something close to 2,000 ohms. 5/8 wave is very close to half wave. In fact, a number of antennas that claim to be 5/8 wave really, I think, electronically are extremely close to half wave. So don't be pigeonholed into thinking that every half wave dipole must be fed in the center. You can feed it anywhere you want if you're smart enough. Center, 30% off to one side, 80% off to one side, outer tip of the dipole. And you get 100% efficiency in all three locations as long as you know what you're doing. So maybe Matt remembers the brand name of that antenna. Over to you, Matt, K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2RIW. I don't know about that particular antenna. It must be antennic. I know that's a very highly used antenna for public safety. It's called ANTENEX, antennic. They make a whole bunch of public safety antennas, and they're one of the biggest companies for public safety antennas.
Two-wheel, Dick. Thank you, Matt. And maybe Rich maybe remembers the name of the antenna also. Go ahead, Rich. And 2EO, K2RIW.
I got two things for you, Dick. First of all, the antenna company you may be thinking of is GAM. G-A-M. That's the first thing. And I went to a site that somebody suggested to me earlier this afternoon. Samlex, S-A-M-L-E-X, Samlex America. Would you believe they have up converters, down converters, DC to DC? So the gentleman, if he's listening, thank you.
Okay, sounds good. So now that you know what you're looking for, half-wave-like antennas will make it a hell of a lot easier. Essentially, no real ground plane is all required, or a thoroughly balanced antenna. Now, because most mobile operations want a vertical antenna, I'll admit that half-wave vertical does represent a little bit of a mechanical structure. If you are home brewing it, a little bit of a mechanical difficulty. And by the way, it has to be only half-wave length electronically. Any antenna you want can be shrunk down as much as you want and still be electronically a half wave if you put a loading coil in the center of it. So it's electronic half wave we're talking about. Doesn't necessarily have to be physically half wave in order to get the benefit we're talking about. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, hope my audio is sufficient, Dick. I know it's usually low. All right. I think you'll have fun with that. I remember Shakespeare made a 2 meter with a can in the center, which was a coil, and that was a half wave. I don't even think they're in business anymore, but I'm sure they're available out there. So, all right. Well, at least he's got a rough idea what he's in for. I'll let it drop. We'll go to the next one.
Your audio is running very well.
Very good. All righty. I have a young gentleman that has permission from his mother and father to put up an antenna. 2 meters, and he's worried about lightning protection. He would like to know exactly what to do, your best recommendation for him. He's going to have it on a pole, a 10-foot pole on top of his house right along the side. and he can come straight down with some type of lightning protection. He also has two ground birds ready, but he wants to know how to ground the antenna. Should he ground the pole? Should he ground the chassis of the rigs he's working with through the same system? Just maybe you can fill him in on what the requirements and what he should look out for. Back to you, Dick. It's 2WGB.
Yeah, at Ham Radio University, almost every year there was an expert on grounding who gives a very nice lecture on the subject. And no matter what you do for lightning, just like no matter what you do for deterrent to make sure that no one can break into your house, you can get 95% of the way there, so to speak. But if you think your house is going to be absolutely bulletproof and bombproof and that no one can ever break into it, that's not quite achievable. And no matter what you do with lightning, you're going to get a lot of protection, but nothing is perfect. But to start off with, try to choose an antenna where the antenna itself has built-in grounding. In other words, if you put an ohmmeter between the antenna and ground, or between the center conductor and the shield of the coax cable, that you measure something, a very low number of ohms, because there's an RF choke in there somewhere, an antenna that can pick up a voltage on the antenna, and it's floating because there's nothing but a coupling capacitor into the radio, that is asking for trouble, in my opinion. Even without lightning, it's just on a dry winter day with the wind blowing and static charge buildup, you can get all kinds of voltage built up on your antenna. Let me drop. To my knowledge, the EIA standard for a ground, Electronic Industries Association, also there was something called the RS-222, probably Delta, RS Radio Sierra-222-D, I think, or E, is the latest version of a recommendation from the Electronic Industries Association. With those letters properly Googled, you'll get a report that'll give you strong recommendations for mechanical, electronic, and whatever installation for antennas and towers, and proper grounding is one of the multiple chapters that are in there. The EIA standard grounding rod is 8.5 feet long, 5/8 of an inch diameter, either copper or galvanized steel, sunk into the ground, right up to the whole length of it sunk into the ground, and with something like 6-gauge wire going between it and the thing that you want to have lightning protection, and that wiring should be as close, as straight as possible between the grounding rod and, in your case, the metal pipe of the antenna. So if the metal pipe supporting the antenna is properly grounded with at least one, and if you want to be belt and suspenders, two of those grounding rods, the 6-gauge wire going through them, and the right kind of an attachment device. Let me drop. So if the pipe itself is well grounded, and if the antenna itself is the kind that has a built-in DC short circuit, obvious by you can test with an ohmmeter, from my point of view, you've done 95% of everything you can do with reference to lightning protection. The very next step above that, I'll admit, is very heroic, and that is to put an adjacent pipe alongside of the antenna that is taller than the antenna, and now that pipe is grounded. That's the next step. If you really want belt and suspenders lightning protection, you provide a nearby structure that's taller than your antenna. It is an innocent chunk of well-grounded steel, we'll say, which now will suck up all the local lightning, and it'll hit it instead of your antenna. But very few people do that. I know of one or two commercial installations that had to do that, where an antenna was being placed on top of a granite mountain, on top of a location in Norway, and local lightning was really fierce, blasting the living daylights out of their antennas. These huge antennas they were putting up, the lightning strikes were so severe, it was vaporizing the fiberglass radome that was around the antennas until they did the structure, putting an adjacent tower alongside of the antenna that was taller, that would absorb the lightning strikes. Don't go there. You don't have to. But that's some of the grounding requirements that I know about. Before I pass it over to John, if you guys have got some further information, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW and the TechNet.
Thank you, Mike Bravo. Dick, I have some comments.
Okay, I heard Barry and Rich in that order. NQMB, go right ahead, Barry.
Just want to bring up the fact that most of the lightning strikes that I've had that did damage to my equipment came through the power line. So you have to do a lot of protection on your power line as well as the antenna.
And WS2N. Okay, and Paul recognized. Yeah, that's a good thing to recognize. If you and I had lightning eyes, in other words, we're flying over the territory, and we're looking down at the territory, and if you've got the eye of a lightning bolt, so to speak, what do you see? You see this huge network of wires going up and down every single street, which is the power transmission and power distribution system for LIPA, Con Ed, New Jersey Power and Light, you know what I mean. There's a huge target there, which is the power line. 98% of the time, the power line is going to be struck first, even though it's not the highest thing. It's just such a huge target. And the bottom line of that is now all of a sudden a 10,000-volt spike or a 100,000-volt spike comes roaring through your power line, and depending on what kind of protection you've got in the house for surge protection for your computers and things like that, that makes the biggest difference. And so I'm a guy with 100 feet of tower on 300 feet of land for the last 40 years in Huntington, and to my knowledge, my tower has never been struck, but my power line has been struck on either one or two occasions, and I did suffer some computer damage, never suffered any ham radio damage. So power line, you got to protect from it first. Good point. N2EO, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
W2AK.
AKE, you're going to be after WS2N. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, when I had my tower, it was a roof-mounted tower by Glenn Martin Engineering in Whitestone, Queens. The power lines were all underground, so I don't think there was a concern there. But the antenna was the highest thing in the neighborhood. In fact, I did get a hit on an Antron 99 fiberglass antenna. There was no damage to the equipment except an antenna switch, and an antenna tuner became a real crispy critter. But everything else was fine. After that, I did some upgrading on a Glenn Martin tower. I had number 6 and number 8 copper coming down from the tower to two ones of it going to two separate ground rods, 8-foot copper rods that had an electrician knock into the ground with a Hilti. If I sat there trying to, this was before I was in a wheelchair, of course, if I tried to hammer them in, it would have taken me all day. He knocked them in with a Hilti in a few minutes. And the copper wire and the rods I got from Glenn Martin Engineering, because I figured they sold me the roof tower, so they're not going to sell me anything substandard on the ground rod or the wire because they have to worry about insurance. Also, I had an air gap, you know, with a point on the very top of the tower. Back to net and 2EO.
Okay, it sounds like that worked out very well. If I get the impression correctly, no further grief after you did that Glenn Martin installation.
Quick info, Dick.
Okay. Right now we've got lined up. We've got Paul, George, and John in that order. Paul is next. WS2X. Say again.
You said Paul and George. It almost sounded like the Beatles. You're just missing Ringo.
That guy Lou's got a good sense of humor. But I'm taking guys in the order in which they signed it. I'm trying to be fair. Paul, WS2N.
Dick, I got a comment on just the recent topic.
That's what we're doing here. All of these are comments. But go ahead, John.
Hey, the K2 UPS just sent me a word here. The half-wave antennas are still manufactured by Larson, Comet, and Diamond. They're readily available. So just wanted that person to know before maybe they left the signed out or something. I wanted to get that info. Okay, back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very good, John. You did have a good point of order. Okay, so Larson and Diamond, still in business, making half-wave antennas, smart companies. Yeah, I'm strongly in favor of balanced antennas. I like an antenna where you feed the feed line into the antenna with the right kind of a balance, and the antenna can radiate all by itself. A fully balanced dipole could be held in the hand, so to speak, of an astronaut who, with his spacesuit, is mounted a mile behind the space shuttle in orbit, 260 miles in the air, and that antenna would radiate like a charm, even though he is 260 miles above the Earth, above ground. There's loads and loads of people who think an antenna will only work correctly if you have nearby high conductivity ground. If you're talking about a thoroughly balanced antenna, absolutely not true. The radiation takes place within the antenna itself. It's only when you start building quarter wave antennas and now you're trying to substitute the other half of the antenna by way of the ground plane radials. But now you've got to do heroic things, if you know what I mean. In many cases, it's a lot easier to add one more quarter wave radio, which is the other quarter of the dipole, and now it's a half wave dipole, and all those ground plane radios are not required. It's another whole philosophy that hasn't been used very much, in my opinion.
And the balance stick, the balanced antenna would not give the astronaut any spin. So there you go.
Yeah. No RF energy would appear on the astronaut when he's doing that. If he's got the right kind of a balancing device between his transmitter, the transmitter line, and that thoroughly balanced half-wave antenna in space. Paul, WS2N, T2I, WS, Paul, with your info.
Okay, I just wanted to mention the ultimate lightning protection system that is used for rockets taking off. You talk about a pipe going above your antenna. Well, they want to do the same thing to protect the electronics on the space shuttle, or now the Falcon 9 rockets that were launched, or even the ones that are launched in Wallops Island. You'll notice four towers surrounding all these rockets nowadays, and they're always higher than the rockets. For instance, one's in Florida. For the space shuttle, we're like 400 feet, so above the height of them, and they had four of them. The reason those towers are there is for lightning protection. Back to you, Dick.
Darn good piece of information. I forgot about them. I remember this installation I lived with at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where they had to put a tower alongside the real radiating antenna on this mountaintop in Norway. Yes, NASA has been doing that for some time. And I think it was either Apollo 12 or Apollo 14. One of those spacecraft, when it took off, was directly struck with lightning, and the astronaut had a very rapidly reset of circuit breaker in order for the blast-off mission to continue. Is that roughly true? If you remember, you're a space person, you probably remember the incident, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW.
Apollo 12, you had Conrad was commander, and yeah, they reset everything 1, 2, 3, and I hope that's the last problem. But they had the lightning strike, and in those days they didn't have these gigantic towers surrounding the Saturn V. Back to you, Dick. Correction. The rocket had taken off, so it doesn't matter. The rocket took off, so it wouldn't really matter if the towers were there or not.
But as a result of that Apollo 12 incident, when Conrad had to reset a bunch of circuit breakers in a hurry, otherwise everything would have gone dead during his blast off, I think NASA, as a result, readjusted their criteria for a proper launch. In other words, their field mills, in other words, their local e-field detecting devices that are scattered all over that field near launch pads 39A at the Kennedy Space Center or at the Cape Canaveral, as it's sometimes called. I think nowadays all of those lightning, local high voltage detecting devices have to be below some particular measurement before they will authorize a launch. Isn't that roughly true?